Hello, everyone. This is Jamie, your host, and thank you for tuning in to the fifth episode of SFN Shorts, where I interviewed early career researchers at the Society for Neuroscience Conference in Washington, D.C. You can find the previous four episodes of SFN Shorts and the reproducibility and rigor jeopardy that I did with a group called Community for Rigor at SFN on the podcast website at inplainenglishpod.org. or in the podcast feed that you are currently listening to. You can also find the posters discussed on today's episode on the website. We will have the sixth episode of SFN Shorts next week on January 30th, so stay tuned for that as well. And without further ado, let's get into the interviews. Our first conversation this week featured Dr. Nicholas Burgraff, a postdoctoral research fellow at Seattle Children's and the host of the NeuroNetwork podcast. The link to which will be in the description. We kind of just launched right into the discussion of the poster, so I'll give a little bit of background. Nicholas's research was on opioids and specifically how they affect breathing and how they affect the areas of the brain that produce the signals that tell your lungs to breathe. So he mentions a lot central pattern generators, which are actually the neurons and areas of the brainstem that are telling you when to take a breath. His lab's research focuses on how opioids affect this, and he was specifically looking at fentanyl and how fentanyl specifically affects breathing, with the ultimate aim of being able to better treat fentanyl overdoses.
So I'll walk it through now. So for a long time, we've been looking at central rhythm generation.
Yeah.
And we're looking at reversing the opioid suppression
yeah.
on central rhythm generation.
Yeah.
But what we're finding is that there's a lot of different ways you can do it,
yeah.
right? I can enhance sodium currents, I can block potassium currents, I can modulate calcium currents. All of them can excite the central rhythm generator enough to evoke bursts, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, we have to actually test in an in vivo model now to see what works. And so we went to the in vivo model. I built a NEMATAC that was able to get airflow on a mouse because normally you get pressure, which doesn't exactly work when you're trying to look at airway dynamics. So we did that. And then for most of the studies, we had been using morphine. And so the standard dose, the normal dose that our lab had been using for morphine was 150 mgs per kg, which is pretty high, but mice take a lot to have a suppression from the opioids.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the same thing with rodents and in goats. Any non-human mammal takes a lot of opioid in order to shut down breathing. So we wanted to switch to fentanyl because it's much more translational. So we switched to fentanyl. And so what I wanted to do was to normalize the effects on central rhythm generation because that's what our previous and background had been on. And so what I did was I gave the 150 mg per kg morphine, saw how much it suppressed the rhythm, and then I gave 500 micrograms per kilogram fentanyl. And what that did was it gave the same degree of breathing frequency suppression.
Okay.
And so the effect on central rhythm generation was roughly normalized. And so serendipitously, I guess, not for the mice, but for us, you know, was that what we found, though, was when you're giving the fentanyl, every time that we gave the fentanyl, you got these obstructions or transient obstructions that were occurring with every breath where you had the diaphragm contracting prior to any airflow. And so under normal circumstances, the air flows in on the initiation of the diaphragm contraction. But with the fentanyl, that wasn't the case. And in morphine, it slowed the breathing rhythm down quite substantially, but you never got the obstructions to occur.
So they're kind of trying to breathe. They're trying to breathe, trying to breathe, and then all of a sudden the air can come in. Okay.
It blows open, yeah. Whereas in morphine, it slows the breathing down, yeah, but it doesn't have any of the obstructions.
At this dose.
Yeah, if you go high enough with the morphine, it will. But at this dose, that normalizes the frequency effect. There was no obstruction with the morphine. So then we had to try to figure out where the obstructions were actually occurring. And so we originally went towards the upper airways. And so we stuck laryngeal EMGs in to look at the laryngeal muscles. And in both fentanyl and morphine, you got about an equivalent suppression of laryngeal EMG activity. So yes, the opioids do shut down the upper airways, make them more collapsible, but it doesn't seem to be explaining the obstructions because it's happening in both the fentanyl and the morphine. So when you stick a laryngoscope down into the upper airways, you do see that instead of the larynx contracting open with every breath, it's just like the diaphragm is building up a pressure that's enough to finally snap the larynx open. So it's just sort of passively being blown open and closed. So, all right, that wasn't contributing to it. So we then moved down the respiratory tree to the lower airways of the smooth muscle containing airways of the bronchioles. And so to get at those, we gave salbutamol and epinephrine. So salbutamol is just albuterol. It's the rescue inhaler. And so it's just a beta agonist. And then epinephrine, obviously, alpha and beta agonist. But what those do when they're given is they selectively dilate the smooth muscle airways, the lower airways, and they don't affect the skeletal muscle, which is the upper airways. And so when you give those, you completely reverse the obstruction from occurring. And so at least it suggested to us that it's likely that the smooth muscle airway constriction is happening to cause the obstructions from the fentanyl. And I don't have it on here, but some of the work we're doing now, when you vagotomize the animals, you completely prevent any of the obstructions from occurring. So it seems to be that the fentanyl is causing overactivation of vagal nerve activity to the smooth muscle airways in particular. And when you go in and you patch clamp from those neurons that project to the smooth muscle airways that are vagal motor neurons in the dorsal region of the brainstem, they uniquely activate and they become depolarized with the fentanyl.
Wow, which is totally reversed.
Which is totally weird, yeah. And so my hypothesis is that there's probably a group of inhibitory neurons that are projecting to those neurons that express the opioid receptor. So you give the opioid, it shuts those neurons down, you disinhibit the vagal motor neurons that then drive constriction of the upper airways.
And so where do you think those neurons are coming from?
I have no idea. We're gonna...
Future direction.
Yeah, one of the grants we have in it right now is to look at that circuitry. And okay. So we have proposed for retrograde labeling of those neurons. So it seems like, okay, we have a pretty good idea that they're activated with the fentanyl. So it seems to be an active constriction process rather than just a collapse of the airway. So that's sort of what we're working on with that. But it, just for the rest of the poster, we also looked at the physiological psi incidence. And so the fentanyl a little bit more potently suppresses psi activity. So there seems to be also a heightened risk of collapse of the alveoli, if you will. And then we just have some housekeeping stuff of O2 saturation and heart rate. But the idea with, we certainly have the central aim that we're trying to study that circuitry that causes that. As far as sort of like a clinical aim, because a lot of my stuff's clinical based, is that what we're trying to do is to reduce the amount of Narcan that's necessary in order to prevent you from dying from the opioid. And so, like, especially in Seattle, there's so many overdoses right now that it's kind of a big problem with the trucks of the medics, where the standard is to give enough Narcan to prevent them from dying, but not enough Narcan to make them conscious because they get very agitated at the back of the ambulance. And so we're trying to figure out ways in order to enhance the potency of Narcan, if you will, or to reduce the amount that you need to give. And so with this, what's nice is that you can give the salbutamol or the epinephrine with the Narcan, and you can cut the Narcan dose by substantial amounts in order to give them just enough to prevent the ventral respiratory column from shutting down. But when you combine it with the bronchodilator, they stay totally oxygenated, even with only a couple breaths per minute. And so it allows you to give very, very small doses of Narcan, but it keeps patients alive. But not so much that they're conscious. So it keeps them unconscious.
Right.
Which is sort of the point, so that the opioid can run its course.
Yeah, that's really cool, and like obviously has very important potential for being able to like treat patients.
Yeah, I hope. Yeah, I think, you know, with a lot of the research that that I'm doing is that we kind of try to stay one or two steps away from the clinic.
Right.
If possible, so that's what we're working on.
I was going to ask if you could see this also kind of being incorporated into the like publicly available like Narcan nasal spray to make it easier to kind of resuscitate somebody if you're just like their buddy And, you know, sometimes the Narcan doesn't always work, or it takes a lot of it in order to, like, revive somebody. So do you see this being potentially incorporated into the, like, publicly available ones?
Yeah, I hope. I think, you know, the reason that I went with salbutamol, which is albuterol, is that it is aerosolized.
Right, so you can nasal spray it the same way.
Because with the Narcan, a lot of, at least in Seattle and the West Coast, as well as nationwide, they're trying to move to the primarily the nasal spray, just because it's, you don't have to deal with the needles or anything like that. And so you can mix this with the nasal spray and it still gets into the system. Epinephrine works as well, like an EpiPen, but the problem is then you have two separate applicators.
Right.
You have the nasal spray plus the EpiPen.
And when you're doing like a public health intervention, you want it to be as easy as possible.
Yeah, one thing, shot, and done, you know. Yeah. And so, yeah, I think, and the nice thing is that it's FDA approved already, and at least for this. The thing is like when we were looking for the different options for the treatments, whenever we're trying to do something with Narcan or replace it, is that one of the best things about Narcan is how fast it works.
Right, it's just like,
it's before you're even done injecting, it's already in. And so it's like, we have a lot of these central rhythm modulators, but they take a long time to work. And so it doesn't necessarily fit. But with this, when we target the airways, it works just as, if not even faster than Narcan itself.
Right. I was gonna say, for asthma, rescue inhalers are designed to be very rapid.
Instant, which was kind of the point, because we had some drugs that were working, but they took like an hour and a half to get into the system. And I was giving presentations in the clinic and stuff, and I was like, I kind of had to bite my tongue, because I knew, I was like, I already know every caveat that's coming out of my mouth, because I'm like, it works great, but it takes an hour and a half. This patient's gonna be dead.
Yeah.
And so this is a cool idea, but like conceptually, but in practicality, whatever we're doing has to work faster or the same speed as Narcan. Otherwise, there's no reason to not give Narcan.
Right, exactly. You're like, well, I'm just going to do this.
Just give Narcan. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so this was kind of one of the ways that was nice to, again, it's not a replacement therapy, but it's an adjunctive therapy to reduce the amount. Yeah.
That's oftentimes the way to go.
Right, yeah. Why, let's not reinvent the wheel.
Exactly.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Because that was
why bet on one horse if you can bet on three?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to look at it. Why bet on one horse if you can bet on three? Yeah, I like that, actually. Yeah, it is, because, I mean, a lot of it is, we know the downsides of Narcan, but at the end of the day, it works. So it's just a matter of, now, how do we make it better?
Right, yeah. Well, thank you so much for recording yourself.
Yeah, you bet.
Our second interview for this episode was with Alex Benedetto, a third-year PhD student at Northwestern University. His research is on using electrical stimulation to treat a symptom of spinal cord injury called clonus. Now, he actually is a spinal cord injury patient and uses a wheelchair, and you'll hear during the interview that he demonstrated what clonus was for me. So I'll describe that so that you know what's happening during that part of the interview. What he basically did was he picked up his leg, lifted it up by the thigh, and then released it. And afterwards, his leg kind of went through a series of involuntary bounces, as if, you know, he was tapping his heel or something, but he didn't have any control over the movement. So that's what's going on when he's talking about or demonstrating clonus to me. And his research was on a potential treatment to help alleviate it.
So can you start out by just introducing yourself?
Yeah, so my name is Alex Benedetto. I am a third-year PhD candidate at Northwestern University. I am co-mentored by Drs. Monica Perez, who's at Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, and CJ Heckman, who works in the Physical Therapy and Human Movement Sciences Department at Northwestern. I am primarily interested in understanding motor control after spinal cord injury. This poster that I'm presenting today is looking at how 20 minutes of spinal stimulation from the surface of the skin lessens this very annoying, like, rhythmic bouncing of the ankle that manifests kind of involuntarily after spinal cord injury. So it's kind of like my broad kind of like my broad interests. I'm like looking at just motor control after spinal cord injury. I have other work that I'm doing as well, but that's what I'm presenting today.
It's very cool, yeah.
So basically what I did was we looked at 8 individuals that have spinal cord injury to varying different degrees of impairment. Some of them have more motor and sensory deficits than others. Some of them are able to walk as well. All of them have been injured for at least 1 year, and the most injured individual has been injured for 15 years. And so basically, yeah, what I'm looking at is what is called clonus or ankle clonus, and it's just this rhythmic bouncing of the ankle that is usually caused by a rapid stretch of the ankle. So if I were to sit here and just like lift up my leg, it'll start bouncing. I have it like really, it's like really easy for me to trigger. Some individuals, it only goes for a few seconds. Others like me, it can go for a full hour. Like if I just sat here, my leg will just bounce for almost forever, it feels like. And so what we wanted to look at was how this, you know, placing these stimulating electrodes on the lower back at the lumbar level of the spine, how that may either increase or decrease this activity. A lot of other studies have looked at this type of stimulation, and when it's paired with activity-based, like exercising, like people walking on the treadmill, it improves their ability to walk or locomotion. And so what we did, we did five trials of the stimulation, or not the stimulation, excuse me, of inducing the ankle clonus. So we had this experimenter stretch the ankle and we let the ankle bounce for up to a minute. And then we recorded the muscle like EMG activity and during that spasm. And then we gave them 20 minutes of the stimulation, and then we did the exact same thing just to see how that activity changed. And what we saw was a drastic reduction in the duration of this like ankle bouncing. And you can see here, in 3 of the individuals, they have really long duration clonus, reduced down to about 5 to 10 seconds. And then in 3 individuals, it almost completely disappears. Completely disappears in 3 of them, and in 1 of them, it almost completely disappears. And so that's what we're looking at. And also looking at changes within like the muscle activity itself, like a little bit more specific mechanisms, but that's kind of like the overall finding, is that this one session of stimulation is able to suppress this really annoying and inhibitory muscle activity. It's kind of like the basic explanation.
Wow.
This would be difficult to do without seeing it, but yeah. Like basically what we see is like an increase in duration between the bursts of activity. So like they're bursting slower, but like the bursts themselves don't really change, like the duration anyways. But so yeah, that's what we're looking at.
That's a very drastic reduction.
Yeah, oh yeah, totally. So the first time I did it in myself, it was gone for about 5 hours. So,
wow.
And I mean, as you can see, I mean, you can't hear, you know, on the podcast, you can't see it, but like, it's super easy to like induce it. You just give it a little stretch and it'll go. But for it to be gone for 5 hours, we were kind of blown away at that. So that's kind of what made us go into it and want to look a little more in depth at what is going on.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what do you think is going on? Like, why do you think that doing this stimulation is like having such a drastic effect?
Yeah, we really don't know. And that's what the next phase is, looking at other mechanisms. So like there's what's called the Hoffman reflex or the H reflex, basically that measures the excitability of your reflexes. So we're going to be looking at that as well to see how that may change. They think that, you know, spasticity itself is due to like hyperreflexia. And so like an increase in excitability of the motor neurons, or like the neurons within the cells that are driving this activity, or the neurons within the spinal cord that's driving this activity. So I think, you know, when you stimulate, you're probably increasing inhibition, so you're able to suppress that hyperreflexia. But with what we've done here, it's kind of hard to make a guess. I really am not sure.
Right, yeah, you're just kind of looking at the outcome.
Yeah.
So then, so do you have, like, what kind of plans do you have to then dive into?
Yeah, so I am not going to be pursuing this part of the project, but we do have another postdoc in the lab that's going to be taking this on a little bit more, more in depth and looking at, like, we'll do a sham session, so we'll, you know, we won't do any stimulation to actually make sure that what we're seeing is significant. We actually might be doing multiple stimulations sessions to see if that changes anything, changing the intensity of the stimulation to see if that has an effect. So like the dosage of the electrical stimulation might be a factor. And then just also other, you know, clinical physiological measurements to see, try and get actually at the physiological level of the cells to see if there's anything there. So that's,
yeah, That's super cool. I noticed that all of the participants are male. Is that because this is more likely to happen in males, or is it, did you just happen to have all male participants?
Well, yeah, it's more likely to happen in males because males are more likely to become spinal cord injured.
Oh, okay.
But Clonus itself, the Clonus itself, there's no correlation. And then also, they just happen to be around. Yeah, I had one female who had Clonus, but then she broke her ankle, so we weren't able to do it. Exactly. Like the demographics itself, I think it's like 75 or 80% individuals that have a traumatic spinal cord injury are male. So it just happens to skew in that direction. But it's absolutely, I don't think it would affect here, but it might as well. You know, like I don't know that there'd be a sex difference here, but that's always a very good consideration. One of my colleagues is looking at neuron like firing behavior between sexes, just looking at across like the menstrual cycle to see how hormones actually impact something like motor neuron behavior.
Oh, interesting.
So it very well could. She's not happy that I only have males for sure, but it's
sometimes that's how the study breaks down.
Yeah, especially in spinal cord injury, it's hard to get an even distribution.
Yeah.
But that's a great question.
And then is there like a relationship between the level of injury? I'm kind of seeing like cervical and thoracic, but no lumbar?
Yeah, so I mean, lumbar injuries are not that common, and we just looked more at cervical and thoracic. So I don't know if there would be a correlation between injury level. They're probably looking at this data for sure. There's a correlation between severity, which is the AIS scale. So A's and B's are more severely injured, or like severely injured, but have more deficits, more motor deficits, and more sensory deficits than individuals that are C and D.
Okay.
So just looking at these individuals, those like if you're AIS A or B, it's shorter duration just to begin with.
Okay.
C's and D's are longer.
Okay.
I don't know if that will hold if we were to expand it. It may just be a consequence of only looking at 8 individuals, but the injury level itself, probably not correlated. It's more about the severity of the injury.
Gotcha. Yeah, that was super interesting. Thank you for going through that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Our final interview for this episode features Dr. Federico Barban, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Genoa in Italy. And his research is on how stroke impacts how the brain is able to plan and form movements. So to kind of go over what he did, because it's a little bit technical, he had mice that were trained on a motor task, specifically reaching for a food pellet that they enjoy. And he recorded from their neurons while they were doing this task before and after giving them a stroke. And he used some different kinds of statistical analyses and graphical analyses to look at how the neurons were involved in planning those motor activities before and after stroke. And the general gist is that in a healthy brain, if you're performing a repetitive task, the pattern of activity in the neurons that are involved in that task should look very similar because they're just doing the same thing over and over again, like reaching for a pellet. But after stroke, since those neurons have been damaged and their connections to other areas of the brain have also been damaged, that pattern looks more disorganized, looks more scattered, looks less similar. And so also the resulting movement is less effective and more has more deficits.
So first, can you just introduce yourself?
Okay, I am Federico Barban. I work in Genova, in Italy, at the University of Genova. I'm doing a postdoc there. And in the past, I worked very closely with Kansas City, the Kansas University Medical Center. The data that I'm showing off, that I'm presenting today, mostly come from that collaboration.
Okay.
What we have here, we are interested in studying the effect of stroke. So we have this stroke model that we're replicating in rats, and it's not the same kind of stroke that you might have in people because it's very focal. So we are able to kill cells just in a very small portion of the brain, and we don't have a penumbra, which is usually an area around the stroke where you have reduced activity due to partial damage to the cells. It has a step border. So all the cells are either dead or not, or perfectly functional. So that's there is a difference there.
Okay.
But it's important for us because we are recording also from the adjacent areas of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that we do, we record from premotor cortex and somatosensory areas, and we induce the stroke in the primary motor cortex.
Okay.
And all the areas that we target are the ones that actually relate with the forelimb of the rat. The rats are trained in doing a skilled reaching task, so they grasp a pellet that they have outside of their cage, and then they bring it back inside the cage.
Okay.
When they do that, they get a point. That's a well-performed task. If at any point they drop the pellet or they're not able to reach it, that's a not well-performed task, that's a fail. And we are comparing how they go and how the neural activity relates to the trial doing before and after the lesion. That's what we're interested in. We have most animals that show a deficit after the lesion, a few don't, because who knows what happens. In biology of that often works, and in behavior that's often the case. Who knows? But the cool thing is that instead of throwing away the data, we can use those animals as internal controls, and we can see what the activity looks like in the animal that still have a well-functioning behavior.
Okay.
All right? And we are using a nice modern technique to visualize the data, which is called dimensionality reduction technique. So we have hundreds of neurons we're recording. Okay. We cannot visualize hundreds of dimensions. We want to see how the activity of each neuron covariates in time. So in order to do that, we do a dimensionality reduction technique, which means we linearly project our variables onto a new space, and then we grasp the three most important new dimensions in that space.
Okay.
And that's what you can see here. And especially we have plotted on top in pink an animal that actually does look like it has a behavioral deficit. It's the pink one, this guy here. Then we have this yellow animal that does not look like it has a behavioral deficit, which is this guy here. And one of the ideas behind this kind of neural dynamics, this is called the technique that we are applying, is called neural dynamics and dimensionality reduction, is that when performing a very specific task, neural activity can lay on a well-defined manifold in the low-dimensional space, so all the trials will be close one to another.
Okay.
All right? When doing similar things, neurons activate in a similar way, and they covariate in a similar way. So all the trials will lay close to one another. But that happens only before the lesion. After the lesion, that manifold collapses, and you don't have that well-aligned kind of activation.
The activation is, it's very like disorganized.
It is organized. In a way, it is organized. And this is not the case for the animal where the behavior is preserved.
Okay, so they still have that nice,
you can see this,
organized behavior.
This is a little more clumpy, a little less organized, but it's day five after lesion. We're still, you know, poking through primary motor cortex. So I think this is a very cool way to visualize data. If you want to bring anything home from this, this is a very nice way to visualize data, because at a glance it gives you more or less the gist of what is going on.
I came over partially because this looks so like,
I know, right?
Interesting and like cool.
But it can also be a nice way to quantify data, because if this, like this tube in space where all the neural activity lays, it's called a manifold.
Okay.
And an hypothesis is that for each behavior, there is a different manifold in this reduced space. And if we can recreate this manifold, maybe we can also recreate the planning that was leading to doing a better grasping, you know?
Right. So I was going to ask, in the animals that do have a big deficit after the stroke, is it just that the physical motion is like less coordinated, or is it also that the like planning that goes into doing that motion is both, less coordinated?
Both of it. I would say both of it. And the big part is somatomotor integration.
Yeah.
So they are trying to grab the pellet.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they cannot feel it, or sometimes they cannot integrate the sensory information into the motor plan that goes into grabbing the pellet. And that will result in a less coordinated activation between the two areas. So what you're seeing here. While if you only look at the motor output, not output, at the motor planning, because we're in premotor areas, this kind of maintains more of a structure than the altogether analysis of all the neurons at the same time.
Okay, so it's the like pulling it together that's really like a big deficit.
Yeah, and that's the hypothesis. By knocking out M1, we are also disrupting the communication between premotor cortex and somatosensory area, because lots of the connection go through it. And the idea is that at this point, the animal cannot integrate that information into the motor plan, and we're trying to see if that's actually the case, and if that goes away with recovery.
Right.
There are also 4 weeks of data ahead of this that I wasn't able to analyze for this, of course.
Right. I was going to ask if you had done this over time and seen, like, does this return back to kind of the pattern that it looks like before stroke?
That's one of the things we want to test. At this point, we're formulating hypotheses and we want to test them. So one hypothesis is that the pattern goes back to what it was before, and the other hypothesis is that the area maybe starts doing something else than it was before, so the pattern should look different.
Yeah, and then so then in people with stroke, this is probably even more pronounced, because you said it's usually a larger area when people have a stroke versus this very small lesion.
Yeah.
So
that's the idea.
In people, could something like EEG or like fMRI be used similarly to help see like how people are, like what deficits they have after stroke, and then maybe direct like physical therapy to try to like improve those deficits in more of a like controlled and coordinated way?
Having electrophysiological data inform the therapist at what point of the therapeutical recovery, of the therapeutical path they are with their patients is a goal, is a right idea. There are some studies that are doing similar stuff with local field potentials, which are more similar to EEG waves than spiking data.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so that's mostly it. And we want to see in the 4 weeks of recovery that we have ahead of this, if we go back to what we had before or no.
Yeah, thank you so much for recording yourself going through your poster.
It's my pleasure, and yeah.
Thank you again for tuning in to this week's episode of SFN Shorts. Once again, the interviewees for this episode were Nicholas Burgraff, Alex Benedetto, and Federico Barban. And once again, you can check out Nicholas Burgraff's podcast, The Neuro Network, wherever you get podcasts. We will be back next week on January 30th with another episode of SFN Shorts. And on February 6th, we will have a full-length episode, so stay tuned for that. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at plainenglishsci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.